From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
The saga of Mexican drug lord El Chapo took a new turn today.
Hollywood actor Sean Penn secretly met with the drug lord in the Mexican jungle.
El Chapo and Sean Penn, their shocking meeting. The world's most wanted drug lord and an Oscar winner deep in a secret mountain hideaway.
What an uproar over Sean Penn's blockbuster article for Rolling Stone on his clandestine interview with the drug lord Joaquin Guzman, the murderous El Chapo. For instance, here's Mexican-American journalist Alfredo Corchado on the BBC.
I'm saying it's not journalism, and to call it journalism is an epic insult to journalists in Mexico and beyond who have paid the ultimate price in seeking the truth.
Maybe Corchado didn't realize he's talking about an Oscar winner and globetrotting anti-imperialist at large, fighter of paparazzi and injustice. But the criticism of Penn has been merciless for merely giving a sympathetic hearing to a man who they say has the blood of 100,000 victims on his hands. Here's retired War on Drugs General Barry McCaffrey on CNN this week.
It's sort of a goofy 10,000-word article, you know, where he asks this notorious criminal what he's dreaming about and how would he want to change the world.
Now, hold on. Sean Penn did not spend 10,000 words glorifying a pitiless sociopath. About 8,000 of the words, including 26 of the first 33 paragraphs, were Penn talking about himself.
Shame on you. You call yourself a reporter? Shame on you. You're nothing but a self-promoting hack.
That's Sean in the 2010 movie Fair Game. And speaking of fair, of course he had to spend pages documenting preparations for the what turned out to be not quite secret meeting. You don't just book clandestine jungle fortress expeditions on Expedia.com. Come on. And then there was the complaint that Penn and Rolling Stone were cynical to cooperate with the notorious fugitive, as per political analyst Gail Trotter on Fox News.
Basically, Rolling Stone and Sean Penn are aiding and abetting a known felon.
Also incorrect. Journalists always have and always will seek out doers of evil, whether you're Bin Ladens, you're Mansons, you're Biebers, what have you. As Jeffrey Toobin observed on CNN,
we're in the news business here, and if someone had given me the opportunity to interview El Chapo, I would have run for that opportunity.
The question is, would Toobin or any other actual journalist have had the artistic sensitivity and surpassing human empathy to truly get El Chapo? Listen to this from Penn's article. This simple man from a simple place, surrounded by the simple affections of his sons to their father and his toward them, does not initially strike me as the big bad wolf of lore. The hard-hitting journalism didn't end there either. There was also an accompanying YouTube video, excerpted in the piece, featuring Guzman answering Penn's brutal written questions.
With respect to your activities, what do you think the impact on Mexico is? Do you think there is a substantial impact?
Not at all. Not at all.
How is your relationship with your mom?
My relationship? Perfect. Very well.
We hear avocado is good for you, lime is good for you, guanabana is good for you, but we never hear anyone doing any publicity with respect to drugs. Have you done anything to induce the public to consume more drugs?
Not at all. That attracts attention. People, in a way, want to know how it feels or how it tastes, and then the addiction gets bigger.
Now, that is true. You don't see El Chapo running Super Bowl ads. Of course, in fairness, the avocado cartel has kept its death toll well below 100,000. But here again, where others see bloodbath, Penn sees thoughtful restraint. Quoting again from El Chapo Speaks, El Chapo is a businessman first and only resorts to violence when he deems it advantageous to himself or his business interests. Penn's point being, Joaquin Guzman is a true-to-life godfather. It's not personal, just business. Not senseless killing, sensible killing. Thank God for such moral clarity. Speaking of which, how about that Rolling Stone? Fresh off its triumphant exposé on gang rape at the University of Virginia, where the only thing the story got wrong was that the rape and cover-up didn't technically, you know, happen, Jan Wenner and his team have surpassed themselves. Any publication can print drivel. Any can print celebrity drivel. But celebrity drivel in sympathy with pure evil? That is something. As Wenner told the New York Times, quote, "It's not a vindication, but a restatement of how good we are, how strong we are." Exactly. Meanwhile, let us give thanks for our newest journalistic hero, Sean of the Jungle. May his judgment and courage never flag.
It's like I told the guy on ABC, danger is my business.
In exchange for the worldwide exclusive, Rolling Stone had to agree to terms laid out to them by El Chapo, the most ethically dubious being that they would allow the drug lord to approve the article before publication. Luckily for the magazine, it turned out that El Chapo had no suggested changes. Penn defended the deal in an interview Thursday with Charlie Rose.
When you get the story that every journalist in the world wanted, there's a lot of green-eyed monsters who are going to come give you a kiss.
Those are jealous journalists you're suggesting?
That, yes.
Still, it's a deal some Mexican journalists say they wouldn't have made. In 2008, Raimundo Riva Palacio was managing editor of El Universal, one of Mexico City's largest newspapers, when two editors rushed in to announce that El Chapo wanted to give them an interview. Raimundo's answer? No.
First of all, I say immediately, we didn't know if that was a trap. The security of the reporter, we cannot guarantee. Because this reporter was a very good reporter who in the past had already been threatened by drug traffickers, drug bosses.
You said no because of security concerns that weren't necessarily idle or melodramatic. Many journalists have died in pursuit of the ongoing drug story in Mexico.
That's right. And also ethical issues here were involved. But basically, these are criminals that had killed journalists. So that was not an unreasonable thought. And at that time, there was a battle between the cartels. And there was a growing number of beheaded people. And I said, well, if we do this, we will be right in the middle of this cartel's battle. So it will be highly, highly dangerous for us to do the interview.
Now, you also mentioned ethical concerns. There is obviously a risk in interviewing powerful people, criminal and otherwise, of being used for their purposes. How did that figure into your thinking?
Basically, if they want to talk to us, it's because they want to send a message. If they offer an interview, we will be implicitly accepting their terms. And why do we have to accept their terms? For the sake of the argument, let's say that the reporter goes there and makes the interview. Will she ask the right questions? Then the problem is El Chapo going to be comfortable with those questions, or are we going to have problems already with this interview? We didn't know that. Let's say also, for the sake of the argument, that he answered the questions. Well, after that, we will publish the story. What happened if he doesn't like the story? We're going to have some problems. But let's say that he likes the story. There will be rivals of him that will be unhappy with the story, and the way they mechanically think is that we side with the other cartels. So why are we going to get into troubles with any of the cartels? So that's another risk.
Raimundo, do you believe that a Mexican journalist could have interviewed El Chapo or any other cartel boss and remained safely in Mexico?
No. If the interview were a free interview, no way. And I also said that what would happen if after the interview, for some coincidence, the security forces caught El Chapo? They were going to believe that we led the security forces to him.
So what you're describing clearly is a lose-lose proposition. But If you run an exclusive interview with El Chapo, you are going to sell a lot of newspapers. I'm curious to know what the publisher had to say about you declining that opportunity.
I never had any problem with the publisher. I didn't even have to explain what was the reasoning. What he wants to do with us is just to serve as a speakerphone for him to send a message. That is not journalism. That is propaganda. We wouldn't accept those terms from the Mexican president. Why do we have to accept those terms from a criminal? A criminal that we know killed journalists.
All right, Raimundo, that was then. This is now. Here comes Sean Penn. What did you think of the Rolling Stone piece?
Basically, I think he was used as a mouthpiece for El Chapo. He never asked really the more important questions that a journalist would ask him. He is an actor. He's a Hollywood celebrity. I couldn't really criticize him to do such a lousy interview. But let me tell you something. The most striking part of the interview for me was that for the first time in his history, he had accepted that he was a drug trafficker. That is the first time I heard that he recognized that he was a drug trafficker. I thought that that was a very important part of the story because he always said he was a farmer that made $1,200 a month. That was what he said all the time.
Sean Penn missed the major news development that it was a confession to international trafficking.
But let me tell you something. El Chapo's lawyer said El Chapo didn't say that. That was a lie. And he never said he was a drug trafficker. Sean Penn lied in the way he wrote the story. El Chapo never said that. And that makes sense to me, because if an interview is not really part of an investigation, it couldn't be used as proof of anything. So now Sean Penn will have to prove that he really had that quote correctly. We're not really talking about journalism. We're talking about entertainment. That was the Rolling Stone piece, just purely entertainment. A Mexican official said yesterday that it was sort of a comedy, and I would agree with that. This is just a comedy, a never-ending comedy.
Raimundo, muchas gracias.
Muchas gracias.
Raimundo Riva Palacio is director of Eje Central in Mexico City, where he writes a weekly column on politics and security.
Coming up, we finally get an update from the Pentagon on when and how it plans to treat reporters as spies.
This is On the Media.
Uh-oh. Alana, Kimmy, Mira, Jesse, Mythili, Alex. This
Hi,
is
Brooke.
What are you, starting
Hi,
a glee club?
Hello, we'd like to talk to you about hats.
Hats?
Alana is wearing a beautiful hat today.
Yeah.
Really jealous of it.
And you know what? I feel pretty.
You look gorgeous, and we would like one.
I'll make them for you, absolutely. That's it?
We don't have to do anything to get hats?
You guys? Well, you do subscribe to the newsletter, right?
No.
Okay. You don't know what you're missing.
That's your first problem. And your last problem, because once you sign up for the newsletter, you'll be entered to win a hat.
That's right. We're giving away two hats, two Brooke-made hats.
Can mine look just like Alana's? Let's just be clear that the staff won't be entered into that drawing.
No.
We'll have our own separate lottery.
But you can go to onthemedia.org.
/
Newsletter. Wait, should we say it together?
What, is this Radiolab?
onthemedia.org/newsletter. And there you can sign up. You put your email address in. You get a wonderful newsletter.
Once a week, it'll have stories from our show and from past shows and stuff we're reading on the internet, sometimes some funny videos. So sign up for the newsletter if you don't already, and you will be entered to win a Brooke Gladstone custom-made hat.
So let's do it this way. Anyone who signs up in the next 3 weeks and anyone who's already subscribed to the newsletter, because that seems fair to me.
Oh, wow. The odds just got really tough.
Well, we want to make
them tougher.
Should we
offer more hats?
All right. Three damn hats.
Three damn hats.
All right, guys. Get out of here.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This summer, the Department of Defense released its long-awaited Law of War Manual, a comprehensive guide to wartime protocols. Shockingly, within the nearly 1,200-page document was language that permitted field commanders to classify journalists as unprivileged belligerents and to treat them as spies. In August, I spoke to Charles A. Allen, Deputy General Counsel for International Affairs at the Department of Defense, about the manual's chilling implications.
We are going to be receiving comments, and those will be considered seriously as we make updates to the manual.
When shall I check back with you?
I'd say perhaps in a couple of weeks we could get back with you.
The Pentagon could not meet that commitment, but now, 5 months later, we do have that check-in. With us again is Department of Defense Deputy General Counsel Charles A. Allen, and he's joined by Pentagon Press Secretary and former Washington correspondent for Bloomberg TV, Peter Cook. Gentlemen, welcome.
Good to be with you, Bob.
Bob, thank you very much for the chance to come back and talk with you.
Where does that revision process stand now?
We are going to be making some changes to that particular section just to make sure that there aren't any misrepresentations or misreading of what was intended.
Mm-hmm. And when can we expect this?
Within the first quarter of 2016.
Bob, this is Peter also, and these changes are being reviewed not only within the DOD, but within an interagency process as well. Changes that have come about as a result of direct interaction with members of the media, with other outside parties who have weighed in, not just on the section regarding journalists, but on the other potential areas of change to the manual itself.
I understand the wheels of bureaucracy turn slowly. However, this was 5 months ago. The United States has a little north of 1.3 million active military stationed worldwide. There are hundreds or thousands of journalists covering them around the world, including two war zones. All of those journalists, at every moment, were subject not only to the risks of the battlefield, but to the risks of rubbing a field commander the wrong way and winding up in the dock for espionage. It's simply hard for me to understand why you didn't suspend the guideline, or whatever it is you're calling it, immediately and then proceed from there.
Bob, this is Peter. As a former journalist myself who looked at this manual when it first came out, and saw language in here that raised my eyebrows as well, that I thought was open to misunderstanding, I'm satisfied that the right steps in a reasonable pace of time are being taken now to address some of those concerns. And you may not be satisfied even with the end result, but people have moved quickly.
And I guess I would also take issue with one of your first comments, Bob, which was correcting an error. In fact, we don't believe that the section is erroneous. We do understand that it has been susceptible to some what I'd call misreading or misinterpretation. And I think we were not as careful as we could have been, and we will be. But again, I would say that it is not in error. It just needs to be presented, we think, in a more careful way. And I actually
I'm sorry, let me just interrupt you to say this. The original language includes this clause. Relaying of information, such as providing information of immediate use in combat operations, could constitute taking direct part in hostilities and thereby disqualifying a journalist of civilian protections. I don't want to seem myself like a hostile belligerent, but as far as I know, in about a century, there has been no case of loose journalistic lips sinking ships. There are many, many cases of rotten apple commanders themselves breaking the laws of war. And I dare say, in such a hypothetical, the commander, under the reading of this language, is far more protected than the journalist in his sights.
Bob, this is Peter. My understanding of this manual is exactly intended to prevent the kind of situation you just talked about. Once people have this manual and the legal advisors around them, any commander who made that decision would be subject to repercussions if at any point it was determined that they made a judgment here that was the wrong call.
I mean, that's right. And Bob, I'm concerned that you have that view that somehow there isn't the incredible respect that we have for the independent journalists. As of right now, the only substantive change in this first revision, which is going to be coming out soon, is in this very area. So what am I doing? I'm admitting that some of the language could have been tighter. I have a hard time stopping myself from the defense of, gee, it's 1,200 pages and this is 2 pages. I'm really pleased with the result we have, but also I'm pleased with what we're going to be doing in response to this.
I'm pleased myself that you're not clinging to that defense, because many an innocent man has gone to the gallows on the basis of one line of law.
Those words of caution, if you will, have resonated. And I think the end result here is going to be something that hopefully the journalism profession will see, that in fact this manual can bolster the position of journalists in a war zone and offer more protections to them in that role.
When can we next have this conversation, when I can see the new regulation right in front of my eyes?
I can't give you a calendar date. I can tell you that it's going to be soon.
Okay. Well, will you men get on the phone with me like this when the new language is promulgated?
I can certainly make a pledge that I'll do everything I can to engage with you, and the Pentagon as a whole will be willing to do that for sure.
And I would definitely do everything I could to be available to Peter, to our other Department of Defense leadership. And again, both conversations I found to be beneficial, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Chuck, Peter, many thanks.
Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Bob.
Charles A. Allen is the Deputy General Counsel for International Affairs at the Department of Defense, and Peter Cook is the Pentagon Press Secretary.
Years ago this week, 26-year-old software developer and political activist Aaron Swartz killed himself in his Brooklyn apartment. He'd been indicted on federal charges after illegally downloading 4.8 million articles from JSTOR, a database of academic journals, and he potentially faced a $1 million fine and decades in jail. These are the basics of Swartz's story, facts that made headlines and introduced much of the world to a computer programming prodigy, a fierce advocate for the free exchange of information, a longtime internet folk hero. Here's Swartz in an interview with the magazine Youth Rising in 2011.
Growing up, you know, I slowly had this process of realizing that all the things around me that people had told me were just the natural way things were, the way things always would be, they weren't natural at all. They were things that could be changed, and they were things that, more importantly, were wrong and should change. And once I realized that, there was really kind of no going back.
I mean, that is a pretty accurate distillation of the way he seemed to have lived his life.
That's Justin Peters. He's the author of The Idealist, Aaron Swartz and the Rise of Free Culture on the Internet. It recounts Aaron's prolific but often troubled life and his tragic death. But the book is much more than a biography. Peters places Swartz within the long, fraught history of copyright in America, alongside other so-called data moralists, with whom Swartz shared key qualities, and an unshakable commitment
to the idea memorably sloganized by Whole Earth Catalog founder Stuart Brand, that information wants to be free.
Information wants to be free is only half of it, right?
Yeah.
The full statement was, information wants to be free because it has become so cheap to distribute, copy, and recombine. Too cheap to meter. It wants to be expensive because it can be immeasurably valuable to the recipient. That tension will not go away because each round of new devices makes the tension worse, not better. The thing that I found so fascinating when I started researching it is that this is not a new problem. This sort of paradox that Brand sort of described in the early 1980s, you know, goes back all the way to the 18th century.
In fact, you launch the book with Noah Webster, famous for his dictionary, but apparently kind of an insufferable prick.
That just about describes it. He's a very difficult dude, alternately insecure and very strident, very upsettable and upsetting to people.
But he's in your book because he's essentially the founding father of copyright in the U.S.
He was perhaps the first American to actually try to make the case to the broader public that authors should have the ability to control their own work so that they can profit from it and make sure that it is being distributed and reproduced in the way that they want.
What was he trying to copyright?
It was a speller, a grammar book that you would use for school children to teach them how to read and write and speak. And it's super interesting because the Revolutionary War is over, and now it becomes a much more extended battle for America's cultural independence. And the primary text that sort of children were using to learn to read and write was this book called A New Guide to the English Tongue, this very dull book by a deceased British schoolmaster named Thomas Dilworth. And Webster eventually came to think, well, why is it that, you know, we are using this book that glorifies British customs and devotes dozens of pages to the proper pronunciation of the names of, you know, Welsh towns when we literally just sort of expelled these dudes? Webster started writing his own speller that he thought would help bring the nation together and create sort of a distinctly American language.
It was a wild success.
It was a wild success. It was published in the mid-1780s, and by 1800, it was selling about 200,000 copies a year, which made it by far the most popular American book that had ever been written.
We didn't have a literature.
No, it was also one of the only American books that had ever been written. There was no American literature. For about the first 100 years of American history, authorship was a hobby. It was something that rich men did, rich women did.
Come on, how many rich women?
There was at least three. At least three rich women. And the whole notion of copyright was Webster and some other authors saying, look, in order for there to be a sustainable literary middle class in America, for the situation to be such that authors can write their own books and profit from their sale and not have to worry about obtaining the patronage of wealthy people in America or doing this in odd hours, then we need a copyright. And we need it to last long enough that authors of books can actually find some sort of sustainable profit from the things that they write.
So in order to push this law through Congress, you note this trail that he makes across the country, assembling letters of recommendation from famous people, not least of whom was George Washington.
Yeah. He showed up at Mount Vernon completely sort of unannounced. That in itself was not particularly weird. It was sort of a thing that Americans did in that post-war pre-presidency era to just show up and shake George Washington's hand. And, you know, Washington invited him over for dinner and started talking about, well, you know, I want to hire a secretary who can be a schoolmaster to my wife's grandchildren. I'm thinking of hiring a gentleman from Scotland. And Webster just got super offended, right? Now, picture this, right? It's George Washington's dinner table. And Noah Webster, this 27-year-old writer of a book that no one had actually read yet, a schoolteacher, stands up and starts lecturing George Washington about the nature of patriotism. He says something like, what do you think, sir, that the British would think if they found that after we had obtained our independence, we had to send away to Scotland for appropriate instructor? What rubbish. There are plenty of men trained in northern colleges who could suit your purpose. Noah Webster was a prolific diarist, and he closed off this story by saying, And then there was silence at table.
And eventually, he does collect a very tepid letter of recommendation.
Washington writes something like, "I cannot speak to the book's merits. The book will have to speak for itself. Goodbye." But that was enough, right? All that he needed was George Washington's name and the names of all these other famous people whose doorsteps he had darkened, right? And one by one, he went to America's various state legislatures, and he gradually sort of persuaded them all to pass their own individual state copyright laws. And then in 1790, the first federal copyright act came about. It allowed for a 14-year initial copyright term, and the copyright could be renewed for 14 more years. Then the work fell into the public domain, which meant that you or I or anyone was free to reprint it, distribute it. The term was limited because Congress was trying to strike a balance, right? They said, okay, yes, it will be good for America to germinate a literary class here. It is also good for America to allow knowledge to spread unfettered.
The Copyright Act that Webster helped get through also means that American books become expensive. But because there's no international copyright, foreign books, which America has always ripped off, are very cheap and they sell by the ton.
So there had been effectively a century in American history in which overseas books could be bootlegged and distributed for free in the United States. Publishers did not have to pay a dime. That was basically how the American publishing industry was built, you know, on the backs of these overseas authors who had no legal right to any compensation. Charles Dickens came to America in 1841 and spent the bulk of his lecture tour repeatedly berating his hosts for their bad manners in taking his books and pirating them and not giving him a dime. And the Americans just basically shrugged their shoulders, like, "Oh, thanks for coming." And then they went on doing it. American writers hated the lack of international copyright because why would anyone publish a homegrown book and take a chance on a new author when they could take a book that had already been established, you know, overseas and sell that for free? So the American publishers and some American authors got together and said, we need to change this. So for a period of about 10 years preceding 1891, they embarked on this extended lobbying campaign in which they attempted to make the case that it was morally wrong to purchase cheap books and that it was morally right to allow authors to benefit from the sale of the fruits of their labor.
And where would be the best place to present a moral argument?
In church. Look, this is literally one of those things that they did. They would convince preachers across the country to work pro-international copyright messages into their Sunday sermons, and they're really ludicrously excessive. This one minister, Henry Van Dyke, I think it was something like, "My neighbor might love the light, but that gives him no right to steal my candles." It's just sort of like stuff like that. And future copyright campaigns would do the same thing. They're like, look, we need to establish that stealing other people's literary property is wrong.
You make the point that in every era, every new piece of legislation renders copyright more and more stringent, more in favor of the keepers of the knowledge than the public interest. So before we get to Aaron Swartz, and we are getting there, listeners, tell me about what happened to the idea of the public domain.
Well, the goalpost sort of shifted as members of the public got excluded from the conversations around new copyright legislation. The interests of authors and the interests of the public gradually began to conflate, right? Until the framers of the new copyright acts were all basically in accord that what was good for authors and publishers was good for the public. And they started saying, look, what is the good of having the public domain? That just means that nobody cares about it. It's like the equivalent of a weedy vacant lot, right? Whereas where the public really benefits is in having these strong, robust copyright terms that encourage creators to create more books and music and film. And that became the argument because there were very few people around to take the opposing viewpoint.
We'll hear more from Justin Peters after the break when he tracks the rise of the free culture movement and the loss of its wunderkind.
This is On the Media.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. When we left off with Justin Peters, Noah Webster's copyright campaign had paved the way for laws that would protect the creators of information, literature, music, film, with robust copyright terms. The idea that the nation needed a public domain rich with free and freely available information was receding. But the advent of the internet created an opportunity for some fervent free culture advocates to step in. In the late 70s, for instance, we encounter Michael Hart, Swartz's spiritual progenitor. Peters suggests that people like Swartz, like Hart, people passionate about information, share certain traits.
Absolutely. I think these sort of data moralists, to use a term that I may or may not have coined, right? They live these lives free from ambiguity of the rightness of their causes, how either expanding or restricting access to information is not just good for readers and writers, but for the country as a whole. And Michael Hart is definitely in that line. He's a critical sort of bridge figure between the old guard publishing world and the burgeoning world of the internet.
Yeah, you call him the beginning of the story of the free culture movement.
Yeah, Michael Hart created the first ebook. It was on July 4th, 1971. He was doing a sleepover in this computer lab at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And he had this sort of flash of inspiration that people have. I've never had one, but one of these days. He had this flash of inspiration. He announces to the people sitting beside him. Sidebar, Michael Hart seems to have spent a good portion of his life announcing things to people who might not have cared to hear it, right? He announced that the greatest value created by computers would not be computing, but the storage, retrieval, and searching of what was stored in our libraries.
Yeah, I mean, think about when he said that. This was when computers were still for crunching numbers.
Yeah, they were basically all used for mathematical and scientific purposes. And here's this guy who had dropped out of college twice, who had been in the army, had left early, had spent years hitchhiking across the country and trying to make it as a folk singer, who finally has this flash of inspiration when he's in his early 20s that he's like, okay, this is what I'm going to do with the rest of my life. I'm going to devote my life to typing up public domain texts and storing them in computers for the benefit of humanity. That's exactly what he did.
He created what may be familiar to many listeners, something called Project Gutenberg.
Yeah, Project Gutenberg was the first general interest online library. He spent the first sort of 20 years of his project toiling in obscurity, sort of bouncing from job to job during the day. He spent the entire 1980s transcribing the King James Bible. It's a very long book, you know.
And he was basically camping out at a university computer.
Yeah, exactly.
They just let him basically couch surf.
Because, like, no one else really knew what they were for. And then the World Wide Web comes along and people start discovering this project. And then they start typing up public domain text that they find and sending them to Hart. And gradually this becomes an actual online library. So in the 1990s, when the commercial potential of the World Wide Web, you know, finally becomes apparent to people, Michael Hart had put 250 e-texts online, which might not sound like a lot, but if you think about the amount of labor required to sit and literally transcribe an entire book on early software programs, then you get some sort of a sense of the hugeness of this accomplishment.
And he gets kicked off that computer.
Yeah. by that point, right around the 20th anniversary of Project Gutenberg, the University of Illinois and indeed the rest of the world is starting to learn what computers are for and what they're not for, right? And they're beginning to realize, well, they're not for people like Hart. And so they revoke his access, and the project maintains. I mean, he finds a new home for it, but the fact that this happened right when, you know, by all rights, the world should be looking at this great, beautiful thing and saying, more please, how can we help? Just sort of illuminates the initial dichotomy that we were discussing earlier of information wants to be free, information wants to be expensive, and there's this endless tension between the two.
So, Aaron Swartz. Swartz is growing up a precocious kid in the suburbs of Chicago, at which time he creates a kind of precursor to Wikipedia. And then at 14, he helps develop RSS, which helps people syndicate information online. And then he meets Harvard Law professor Lawrence Lessig when he's 15, and he gets himself involved with Lessig's effort to create a way to provide information for free under certain circumstances.
It was a project called Creative Commons, an attempt to create a middle ground for copyright in the digital era, where you could go on to Creative Commons and register your content with a Creative Commons license, which was basically just a signpost you'd put up to say, okay, if you are using this, for example, for nonprofit purposes, just give me credit. Or you could say, look, anybody can use this photograph or this song or this short story. It was basically an attempt to say, look, our copyright law at this point needs to adapt to the realities of the digital age. But if it's not going to adapt on its own, then we'll find a workaround.
As we follow Swartz, he drops out of high school. He then applies to Stanford, gets in, drops out of there. He's involved with the founding of Reddit. And somewhere along the line, you write about Swartz reading Noam Chomsky's book, Understanding Power.
On his blog, he wrote that after he read Understanding Power, he was literally struck down to the floor. I think he said something like, I couldn't stand up, I couldn't think straight, I had to grasp the doorknob to keep myself upright. Anyway, after reading that book, something seems to have switched, and he seems to have realized, now that I've seen this, I can't unsee it. Now that I've seen how power works and accumulates, I can't pretend that I don't know how the world works.
I mean, we're still talking about a kid here.
Yeah. I mean, he was 14. He was 14 or 15 when he started working with Creative Commons. By the time he's writing about Noam Chomsky, he's barely 20 years old, going across the country speaking to groups about the moral necessity of liberating pieces of culture and information that are held as literary property.
And in fact, he embraces revolution.
Of a kind, yeah.
He drafts the Guerrilla Open Access Manifesto. He starts the Content Liberation Front. I mean, these are phrases at least designed to evoke revolution. And I have a quote here from the Guerrilla Open Access Manifesto. It's time to come into the light and, in the grand tradition of civil disobedience, declare our opposition to this private theft of public culture. We need to take information wherever it is stored, make our copies, and share them with the world. We need to buy secret databases and put them on the web. We need to download scientific journals and upload them to file-sharing networks. We need to fight for guerrilla open access. With enough of us around the world, we will not just send a strong message opposing the privatization of knowledge, will make it a thing of the past. Will you join us?
And then 2.5 years later, he's arrested at MIT after having downloaded 4.8 million academic journal articles. He never admitted or said what he was planning to do with all of the material he had acquired. You know, the federal government certainly took the Guerrilla Open Access Manifesto to heart. And they said, look, he wrote about taking these gigantic data sets and freeing them to the world. Then he downloaded all of this material. So it was clear to them, at least, what they thought that he wanted to do with it.
So tell me how the case unfurled.
Yes. Yeah, so it's the beginning of January 2011 when he's first arrested. And at first, they bring him up on, you know, state breaking and entering charges.
Because he did it from MIT.
He did it from MIT where he was not enrolled and he wasn't sort of employed there. But then federal prosecutors get involved. This joint computer crime task force that was working the case with MIT cops, Cambridge cops, and the Secret Service. And
now, basically, JSTOR, this repository of academic journals that you have to subscribe to, probably wouldn't have cared except that he was doing it on such a massive scale that it slowed down and crashed their servers initially.
Yeah, he was making hundreds of download requests per second, and that was a big strain on the JSTOR servers. And the JSTOR staff looks at this activity and thinks, whoa, someone is trying to siphon our entire archives. So they started telling MIT, hey, you got to find the guy who did this. And when they found him, and they found out that it was Aaron, not some, you know, malicious hacker, but a guy who had in many ways established himself as, if not the conscience of the internet, at least one of them. No one really knew what to do with him.
Except the prosecutor.
Oh, they knew exactly what to do with him. They wanted to put him in jail. And they would not budge from that stance. And they charged Aaron under something called the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, the CFAA, which is America's sort of omnibus computer crimes legislation that serves to prosecute malicious hackers who are trying to tap into government computers to find state secrets. It can also be used to prosecute you or I if we sort of violate a website sort of terms of service. It's an incredibly broad sort of piece of legislation. And so Swartz returned all the documents he had taken. He gave them back to JSTOR. And then JSTOR called the prosecutors and said, look, we've got what we wanted. We have no interest in seeing him go to jail. We have no interest in seeing this case proceed. And the prosecutors said, thank you very much, duly noted. And then they delivered an indictment that could have theoretically landed him 35 years in a federal prison. And then they delivered a superseding indictment that upped that to a potential 90 years. He never would have received the maximum sentence that was just there for scare value. But still, the lead prosecutor in the case made clear that if they went to trial and if Swartz lost, that the prosecutor would ask that he be sentenced to around 7 years in federal prison.
The boy and the man you describe, Aaron Swartz, couldn't handle any confinement. He couldn't make it through high school. He couldn't make it through college. He couldn't even work at a cozy, comfy job at Reddit.
He was a very sensitive kid who couldn't stand having to play by someone else's rules, by which I mean, you know, he was a product of the internet, where this sort of collaborative digital world in which you advanced by sort of the strength of your own ideas and your contributions to the group, right? And if there was a better way of doing something, a better way of solving a problem, then everyone said, great, you've found a new way. Let's do that. That dynamic just is very hard to find in the real world. You can't go to high school and say, all right, we've got this four-year structure here. I've got this better way that is better suited for me. He tried to do that. They said, duly noted, no. So he left. He was in the first class of Y Combinator startups. Y Combinator is like the big startup incubator that's, you know, relatively famous. He couldn't take that. He did not like being forced to work on one thing that was not his thing.
If it didn't have the potential to change the world, he lost interest. One of his friends said that he always felt like they were disappointing Aaron, that they couldn't live up to his standards.
Well, you know, he was the sort of person who was a great friend but could be a difficult collaborator because his mind was working on a different frequency than everyone else. And I think that was partially why he ended up starting so many projects and then leaving them, because they couldn't live up to his own standards.
So how did he die?
It was January 2013. It was becoming more and more clear that this case wasn't going to go away. He got new lawyers. They were very good lawyers, and They were going to try to convince a judge to exclude a bunch of evidence that the government was planning to use. That's the thing that kills me, that I just don't understand after living with the story for so long. It felt like things were looking up for him, right? After living under the strain of an extended indictment for 2 years at that point, the case was looking like it might resolve in his favor. And he had a girlfriend whom he loved, and their relationship had never been stronger. And everything seemed to be going so well. And then one day, his girlfriend comes home for work to find him hanging by his own belt. And the entire world sat up and asked why.
There have been basically two competing narratives about Aaron Swartz since he died. One is that he was a restless, frustrated young man, a high school, college dropout, a social misfit, a difficult colleague. And then there's the narrative that asserts he was smarter than all of us, possessed with more commitment and integrity, and generally just too good for this world. And actually, those narratives don't preclude each other. Both could be true.
He's an idealist, someone who has a very clear idea about how the world should be and about what he can do to bring the world to that point. And yet, he was ill-equipped to deal with how the world actually was.
Did your opinion of him change as you reported the story?
It did. Honestly, at first I came at this story on sort of the side of stringent, you know, copyright. I'm a journalist. I've seen a lot of my friends, you know, lose their jobs in this last decade because no one's paying for content anymore. And the more I learned about this story, the more I'm like, this is an extraordinary guy. You know, you know what he was? He was a herald. Yeah, this is near the end of my book where I sort of try to sum it all up. It says, 3 years on, the story of his life and death serves as a necessary reminder that there is a fundamental disconnect between our laws and our habits, between the way we are supposed to conduct ourselves online, the way we actually do. We can amend bad laws. We can promote better culture. We can choose to create systems that can be opened without breaking, that tolerate deviance without collapsing, that regard the unfamiliar not as a threat, but as an opportunity. Who Aaron Swartz is to me, he's the sort of living manifestation of those ideas. And those ideas are supremely important today, tomorrow, in the future, as information continues this paradoxical need to be free and expensive. You know, what it ends up as, it's up to us.
Justin, thank you very much.
It's such a pleasure, Brooke.
Justin Peters is author of the new book, The Idealist, Aaron Swartz and the Rise of Free Culture on the Internet.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, and Mythili Rao. We had more help from Alex Friedland, Dasha Litsitsina, and David Conrad. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Casey Means.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.